Have you ever thought of the Constitution as literature? Maybe even as a poem? Well, consider this. O Captain, my Captain, our fearful trip is done. The ship has weathered every rack. The prize we sought is won. The port is near. The bells I hear. The people all exulting. While follow eyes the steady keel, the vessel grim and daring. But heart, O heart, 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 the bleeding drops of red. Or on the deck my Captain lies, fallen, cold, and dead. Now that's a poem, and that was written by Walt Whitman to memorialize Abraham Lincoln right after the Civil War. So you see, a constitutional poem is not out of question. But is the Constitution itself a poem? Is it in fact an epic? Well, Garrett Epps thinks so, and we're going to talk to him all about it. It's your Weekly Constitutional. I'm Stuart Harris, and it's all about American epic.
Your Weekly Constitutional is hosted by Professor of Law Stuart Harris and underwritten by the Robert H. Smith Center for the Constitution at James Madison's Montpelier.
Garrett Epps is a fellow I've known for a number of years. He's a very, very good writer. He's a professor of constitutional law at the University of Baltimore's law school. He's also a journalist by trade. He writes a regular column for The Atlantic. And recently I noticed that one of his books is coming out in a paperback edition. It's called American Epic, and it has a really fascinating theme, a really fascinating idea, and that is the Constitution, when read as a whole, as every American should, when we read it as a whole, it actually is sort of like a poem. In fact, it's sort of like an epic poem. Now, that may seem very odd to you, and certainly as a lawyer and law professor, it seems odd to me. But Garrett Epps actually makes a pretty good case for his thesis. Let's listen in and see if you agree.
My name is Garrett Epps, and I am a professor of constitutional law at the University of Baltimore, but I'm also the Atlantic Supreme Court correspondent. So I call myself professor in the press room, and it's a very interesting role, and there aren't many people exactly like me.
No, there aren't. In fact, you inhabit at least two worlds. In fact, you've got a rather illustrious journalistic career behind you, haven't you?
Well, I was in the news business. I don't know about illustrious, but I certainly worked a lot of places for 15 years before I went to law school, including the Washington Post and the Richmond Afro-American and a number of interesting media outlets. So I have a foot in both camps for sure.
Yes, you do. Well, this background you have gives you, if not a unique qualification, certainly an unusual one for law professors, and that is that you actually know how to write. You write quite well.
I don't know if I write well, but I don't know if you know the old saying in the news business, we don't want it good, we want it on deadline. I certainly have learned to write fast, which is a great aid in a lot of things, and particularly in the work I do now, which involves posting 1 to 2 1,500-word essays a week on the Atlantic website.
Wow, that is a remarkable feat, and I congratulate you on it. But of course, we're here today to talk specifically about your most recent literary endeavor, and you've written a book with an epic title, American Epic. Could you tell us a little bit about that?
Yeah, this is almost the antithesis of covering news and everything else. This was my own private project of wanting to look at the text of the U.S. Constitution through a number of different lenses as a text, because the striking thing to me about Americans is that we just revere the Constitution. We think the Constitution is the be-all and end-all and a great work of wisdom. As for actually reading it, no, we're kind of busy. We don't want to do that. And there's a very well-known satirical article that ran in The Onion that said, "Area man, passionate defender of what he supposes Constitution says," and goes on and on about a number of things that this guy believes in that aren't in the Constitution.
Yeah.
That's very common to have people say, well, you know, the Constitution guarantees life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. Well, not so much. That's really actually the Declaration of Independence, but you're close. And so I thought, what if we actually took seriously the idea of reading the Constitution, not as a few phrases, but as a text, as a work. And the reason I said epic is that the Constitution is very much like the ancient epics of the Homeric period, in that it's the work of a number of authors written over a 200-year period, and those authors use certain kinds of verbal formulae to signal that they're doing the same thing that the earlier authors did, and our job is to try to read it as a whole, even though it wasn't written by one person or even one group of people.
Well, that's the first time I've ever heard the Constitution described as a Homeric epic, and I'm just intrigued by this. And so, if I understand, you actually go through the entire document in your book line by line, and then you comment on that. Is that basic structure?
Yes, pretty much. I don't want to say it's a commentary. We've got a number of really wonderful commentaries on the Constitution, starting with Justice Story's commentary from the early 19th century. And I'm not trying to do legal comment. I'm trying to say, you know, what do we find in these words? What do we find in these phrases in this document that tells us something about who we are as a people and what it means to be a nation that is committed in its primary political commitment to a written document? Americans don't sing God Save the President or God Save the King. We don't declare our allegiance to a nation. We are loyal and we take oaths to the Constitution of the United States. Well, what is it this document tells us? And from the very beginning, you know, from the preamble, which really serves the function in the Constitution of the invocation to the muse in the Iliad or the Odyssey, we are speaking about who we are, we the people of the United States, and we are ordaining, which is a kind of sacerdotal and holy thing to do. We are ordaining and establishing also has a religious meaning, a constitution for certain purposes, which we lay out in the text. And so the Constitution begins by speaking in our voice. And as we read what it says, we ourselves are learning to come to terms with these words that have been uttered in our name. So there's a lot of different ways to read the Constitution, and certainly many, many more useful ones than just sort of picking a phrase out here or there, or even worse, putting a phrase in here or there, which is very common. And I can go into some of those examples if you want.
Oh, yeah, we'll definitely do that. But before we go on, you've said a couple of things that really struck me. And one, of course, is that the way people treat this like holy writ without having read it, which actually reminds me of how people do treat that other holy writ, the Bible. And they will wave it around, and they will pick and choose bits and pieces of it. But oftentimes, it's actually a rarity for someone to have actually read the whole thing that they claim is so important to them. The other thing you mentioned that really struck me personally was that people take an oath to this Constitution without having read it. And I hate to admit it, but when I was 19 years old, I took exactly that oath when I joined the military, and I don't think I had read the whole document as of that time. And that really is remarkable, isn't it?
It is, and I think that our schools have not, you know, heretofore done much of a job of teaching people just what's in the Constitution. And simply to say to people, sit down and read it. You know, I say that to my students in Constitutional Law 1. These are law students who have training and inclination to read long and somewhat abstruse texts. But they think I'm kidding, you know. And so on the first day of class, you know, I'll say the assignment for the first day of class is to read the Constitution and come to class prepared to answer questions on certain topics. And they show up, and I say, are you prepared to answer questions on these topics? And of course they say yes, and then I give them a quiz. They're outraged.
They're always outraged when they get a quiz, but
they're,
you think
they're outraged. I said you said you could answer questions. Here are some questions for you. But the point is they don't really believe that I was serious about reading the entire Constitution. That seems just wrong somehow, because it's got a lot of stuff in it that who cares about. And I really am trying to combat that mentality, in part because I think it leads to some fairly distorted political and legal effects, and in part just because once you bite the bullet and read the whole thing and really commit yourself to that kind of textualism, there's a tremendous amount of fun and meaning and history and poetry that is present in the Constitution that we cheat ourselves from by our current means of reading it.
You know, Garrett, I couldn't agree with you more, and that's funny. That is always my first day's assignment as well. I've yet to actually give a quiz on it, but now I'm actually thinking of crafting a question or two about letters of mark and reprisal.
Right.
That's something. But no, I actually tell my students that every lawyer certainly should have read the entire document at least once. And I further believe every American should have done so. And so, we're both doing our little part to make sure that they do that. Well, okay, we won't have time in this very brief interview to go over every aspect of the Constitution. People will have to get your book for that. And just so that people can do that, what's the full title of it?
It's called American Epic, Reading the U.S. Constitution. It's just been republished in paperback from Oxford University Press. And is available from Amazon, et cetera. And it is not written for lawyers. It is not a legal book. It does not contain a lot of footnotes. It's a text about a text. And it ought to be a lot of fun for people to read.
Okay, I'm sure it will be. But now, in the time we have, why don't you hit some of the high points for us? Why don't you think back on writing this and tell us some of the more interesting things that you learned or that you write about in your book?
Well, I think that one of the places that people really enjoy in this book is the essay on the Second Amendment, because my basic view about the Second Amendment is that all of the ways courts and people have tried to understand it are pretty much useless, because it's not really an abstruse or complex legal text. It's really a kind of a poem.
And a poem.
A poem, and I compare it to a poem called "Revolution Is the Pod" by Emily Dickinson, which is one of her poems. Coming to terms with the impact of the Civil War, revolution is the pod, systems rattle from when the winds are will are stirred, excellent is bloom, but except its russet base, every season be the entomber of itself, so of liberty. What she's saying is in that the American Revolution and the drive for liberty is like a seed pod that has seasons. It grows, it flourishes, it's green, then it dries out, breaks open, and scatters seeds for a fresh revolution. Similarly, the Second Amendment is giving us an image of a country, a well-regulated militia being necessary to the security of a free state. The right of the people to keep and bear arms shall not be infringed. That is a series of images. It's not a series of logical links. We have the well-regulated militia. We have the people. We have bearing arms. All of these things have historical connotations. They conjured up images at the time they were written, and they conjure up images today. And we have to try to piece together what I think is really just more of a statement about what kind of country we are than a specific set of guidelines about whether people can have AK-47s or all weapons have to be kept at the armory. And people find that have found that very threatening. I've had a number of very hostile responses to this, because both sides in the gun debate want the amendment to really answer all questions and answer them in their favor. So the sort of what I'd call the gun hawk side says, you know, the right of the people to keep and bear arms shall not be infringed. That means government can't pass any laws that you know, people can have any kind of weapon anywhere they want at any time, and I don't want to hear any qualification of that. Of course, the other side, you know, represented by people like Michael Waldman, who just wrote a book called The Second Amendment, a biography, their view is, no, it's only about the militia. There can't be any individual right to possess arms, period. And I don't want to hear that there's any ambiguity in this. It's a kind of a nutty dialogue, if you think about it, because if there's any part of the Constitution that is more magnificently ambiguous than the Second Amendment, I don't know what it is. It is sufficiently ambiguous, as I say, to be poetic.
I don't know that that's necessarily a virtue. It may be in a poem that's a virtue, but in a constitution, I'm not sure that I would call ambiguity magnificent.
Well, you know, the ambiguity may or may not be desirable, but that doesn't mean it's not magnificent when it is attained.
It's Weekly Constitutional. I'm Stuart Harris, and we're feeling very literary today. We're speaking with Garrett Epps, who's a law professor as his day job, but I think secretly he's sort of a poet, because that's the way he looks at the Constitution, as epic poetry. After the break, we'll have ourselves a constitutional quiz, and then we'll come back and talk some more with Garrett Epps. Stick around. Doug, you're making me dizzy. You're sitting in your swivel chair. You're swiveling back and forth. It's sort of rhythmic here. Is this sort of a Zen thing?
I'm doing my my quiz show dance.
Your quiz show dance? I've never seen it before. Is this a new thing?
I don't want to do a snow dance. It's snowed so much lately.
A snow dance. All right. Feeling good. Glad to have you with us. Do we have anybody on the line?
Yes, you do. Robbie Minton over here.
Robbie, from where?
From Grundy, Virginia.
From Grundy, Virginia. My. Beautiful Grundy, Virginia. Well, we're so happy to have you. Are you ready to take a quiz, Robbie?
I will try.
Tremendous. Doug, you have a hard one for Robbie?
I don't know if it's too hard, but, you know, I think Robbie's going to knock it out of the park.
I can
feel it. Okay. Robbie, are you ready? I'm going to read you a question. I'm going to give you four choices.
All right.
Here it comes. Very short question. Robbie, where is Runnymede? Where is Runnymede? Is it in A, Botswana, B, England, C, France, or D, Tennessee?
England.
England? Why did you immediately go to England?
Why did I immediately go to England? Because I believe it's near, Windsor's might be around that area? Windsor Castle?
Windsor Castle may be around that area. What, are you some sort of geography guru or what?
I was kind of a geography nerd growing up, maybe. You could say that.
Well, but I want to hear, why is it not Tennessee? That sounds kind of like a Tennessee place.
Why
to
is
me.
It not Tennessee?
Yeah.
Well, I mean, you could have a... You actually do have, you know, I mean, you have a London, United Kingdom. You have London, Kentucky. You know, I mean, there could be a Runnymede, Tennessee. It
right.
almost sounds like one of the Elizabethan towns out there near Sinking Springs or out there near the river.
But it's not Botswana, and it's not France.
I don't think it's Botswana, sir.
Okay, and it's not France, otherwise it would be Runnymede.
You know what, in Kentucky they have a Versailles as well, but they call it, no, Versailles as well, but they call it Versailles.
Okay, there's the Lafayette, I know, that's in Tennessee.
Paris.
Exactly.
Paris, Kentucky.
I've heard that as well, but we're just riffing here because, Robbie, you, I'm going to let Doug.
Lebanon, Virginia.
Yeah, well, okay, Damascus, Virginia as well, but did Robbie get this one correct?
He did, absolutely. 800th anniversary of the Magna Carta in 2015. It all happened there on those sparkling shores at Runnymede.
At Runnymede. Well done, Robbie.
Very much, Professor Harris. Thank you all.
Absolutely. You just knocked it out of the park. You went straight to it. And I guess studying that geography really paid off.
Yes, sir. I would actually like to thank the Virginia SOL testing. And
You are the first person who's ever...
That was a little joke.
Tremendous. We've got one guy at least who enjoyed taking his SOLs. Well, thanks very much, Robbie, and thank you, Doug.
You bet. Hey, you know, 1215, Runnymede in England, King John makes the pact with the barons. Right there. Runnymede, Ronnie, Robbie got it. Those SOLs work. It's
SOLs
the Constitution.
At work.
800 years, though. Lord.
800 years. It's the Constitution. We read it for the articles.
You're listening to your weekly Constitutional. I'm Stuart Harris, and I'm speaking with a poet, at least a poet at heart. His name is Garrett Epps, and in his day job, he's a law professor at the University of Baltimore Law School, and he's a really good writer. I've actually read some of his stuff, and it's very well done. And one of his more recent efforts is a book he published back in 2013 called American Epic. It's now out in paperback. And American Epic has a very interesting perspective on the Constitution. It considers it to be an epic poem, with all that that means. It's somewhat ambiguous. In fact, just before the break, Garrett was referring to its magnificent ambiguity. Magnificent ambiguity. Now, I practiced law for a number of years, and I never considered ambiguity to be magnificent. I think now we're going to go and talk about the Second Amendment, and we'll just see how magnificent that ambiguity
one
is.
One of the things that strikes me about the Second Amendment is that, like a lot of the other parts of the Bill of Rights, it is written very carefully. Remember, James Madison was the author of the provisions that became the Bill of Rights, and his spirit, you know, broods over all those 10 amendments. Madison, contrary to what people have been taught, really distrusted and disliked state governments. He did not believe they were useful players on the national scene, and as a result, he is very reluctant in the language of the Bill of Rights to recognize any prerogatives of state government. In fact, you know, there's a pretty good historical argument that the Bill of Rights, as written by Madison, was written and pushed through Congress very hurriedly in order to forestall an effort to produce a different Bill of Rights that was going on by Patrick Henry and the other states' rights people that would explicitly limit the federal government's power and say the states have this power and so forth. Madison didn't want that. The result is that whenever he talks about states, he does so sort of between clenched teeth. And I think that if he actually meant to say, and I think there's a pretty good case that this is the truth, if he actually meant to say the following: look, even though the federal government has control over the army, and the federal government can call the militia into the active service of the nation anytime it wants, we promise you that the federal government will never disarm the state militias and tell the states they can't maintain their own military forces. That's a promise. If that's what he intended to do, and I think there's a good case that it is, the fact that he was so reluctant to say anything nice about the states sort of dooms the meaning of the movement, of the amendment. He just simply can't bring himself to say states have the power to do X. And so he goes into this airy thing about the people, the rights of the people to keep and bear arms, and, you know, a well-regulated militia. It is magnificent ambiguity that doesn't make it useful as law, but it is part of the reason it has such a hold on our national imagination about who we are.
That's very interesting. You should bring that point up. You're right. Madison is often cited as just another Jeffersonian who, of course, is someone who's in favor of states' rights. And so there, of course, we need to interpret the Bill of Rights that way. But he actually proposed during the convention that the Congress would be able to veto state laws.
Absolutely. And if you go back and look at the documents that lead up to the Philadelphia Convention of 1787, particularly his vices of the current system, which is a memo he wrote for himself and a few others about why we needed a new constitution, he basically thought the state governments were just the worst possible thing. They were parochial. They were sort of very mutable. They never could follow any policy. And he was very concerned, and I think many people at the convention were deeply concerned, that because of the parochial nature of the state governments, because the government of Virginia or Philadelphia really didn't care about the Confederation. It cared only about its local interests. The United States was going to lose its independence, which had been so dearly won. The United States would lose it very soon, either formally in the sense of being recolonized by one of the European powers, or, you know, in practical terms, by coming under the influence of France or England or Spain. And of course, the other possibility was that the country would split up into maybe three confederations, each one with a European patron, and we would duplicate on the North American continent the long, long series of nationalistic wars that had occurred in Europe since medieval times. So he was deeply concerned, and I think a lot of the framers of Philadelphia were deeply concerned with what we today would call national security. And I've often thought of calling the Constitution, just for people to think about it, the National Security Constitution, because we are very confidently told by various political and religious and cultural figures that the purpose of the Constitution was to limit the federal government, that the framers came together in Philadelphia to prevent an overreaching federal government from crushing liberty. And historically, this makes no sense at all, because there basically was no federal government in 1787. And so the idea that people rushed to Philadelphia to prevent it from becoming too strong is just ridiculous. It makes no sense at all. All they had to do was do nothing, and there would not be a strong federal government. In fact, their concern, and there's an element of terror in this, if you read what they're saying, their concern is that the federal government will not be strong. They want a strong government that can cope with the things that need to happen on the international plane and in terms of commerce and relations among the 13 states in order for the country to survive and become independent on the internet, on the world scene. What
Madison and his cohorts would call an energetic central government.
Absolutely.
It's very interesting you should say that. And so given Madison's attitude, your perspective is that the Second Amendment was an attempt to outmaneuver states' rights people, real states' rights people like Patrick Henry, and give a somewhat ambiguous sop to the states that, don't worry, we're not going to disarm you, and now please ratify this Bill of Rights and this Constitution.
Yeah, that's right. I think the whole thing has a kind of a grudging tone to it, and never more so than in the Second Amendment. And, you know, Madison was a great man, but he wasn't infallible, and I think he put a foot wrong in the text of the Second Amendment.
But he ended up with poetry. All right. Well,
what
else do we have? What else did you find interesting in the text of this document that maybe, you know, Madison and the Second Amendment are fairly familiar ground for us, mm-hmm. and I'm glad we covered it, but what in your writing, what in your research did you come up with that listeners might find particularly surprising?
Well, you know, I think one of the really interesting things to do, because we tend to think of the Constitution, and you mentioned the Bible. There's a section in American Epic that compares American constitutional reading to the fundamentalist theory of biblical hermeneutic, you know. And fundamentalism is an American religious tradition. It emerged in this country about 100 years ago. And it is centered around a very particular view of the Bible. And that view is that the Bible is the inspired word of God, meaning not only that the ideas behind it are divine, but that the very words were dictated to the human soul by God. And we tend to read the Constitution very much the same way. And we tend to project onto the Constitution a certain consistency that it actually lacks.
Garrett. Yeah. You're telling me that the Constitution was not written by God?
No, it was not. It was written by someone else of the same name.
Oh.
It obviously was written by human beings who were acting in a very, very short time frame. If you think about it, the convention gets underway in May, and it concludes in September. And this is quite a lot to do in that period of time, is to design an entire government. And parts of the government are done designed very, very well, and parts of it are just sketched in. So one of the really interesting things to do is to compare Article 1, which sets up Congress, with Article 2, which sets up the presidency. And the framers who were in Philadelphia knew quite a lot about legislative bodies. Virtually all of them had served in their own state legislatures or in the Continental Congress. They obviously knew a lot about Parliament because, as having grown up as British subjects, they knew the theory of parliamentary supremacy, that in the British system, there was no, you know, there the king and there was the Parliament, and Parliament was the group that made all governmental decisions. So they wrote Article 1 in great detail. Congress is set up very carefully, and you come to Article 1, Section 8, which is one of my favorite parts of the Constitution, and that is the set of powers that Congress has. And I discuss this in a chapter called The Shield of Achilles, because I compare it to a section of the Iliad in which Hephaestus, the god of the underworld, the great smith of the underworld, creates a magical shield for the warrior Achilles, and the shield somehow in intaglio on the outside in bronze contains sculptures or bas-relief that represent the entire life of Bronze Age Greece. Cities and people marrying, and law courts, games, races, armies fighting, and so forth. The shield itself becomes the world, and all around it is set the ocean. Article 1, Section 8 is obviously a list of powers that Congress has, but it really is something more than that. It is such an epic catalog of powers that it really becomes a kind of picture of the country that the framers hoped to produce, a country with thriving commerce, with invention, with art. You know, all of these things are mentioned by name in this list of powers. And so you read it, and if you read it as a whole, now, of course, Americans don't read it as a whole, and lawyers are the worst. You know, for example, we like to talk about the interstate commerce power, as if there were some part of the Constitution that says, you know, the Congress has power over commerce that goes between states only. But it doesn't say that. It says Congress has power over commerce with foreign nations and with the Indian tribes and among the several states. In other words, it just describes a huge universe of commerce and says Congress has power to regulate this. So you read that and you think, you know, if you read it openly and as a whole, you get a pretty detailed picture of what it is Congress can do. Then you go over to Article 2. If you try to read Article 2 and understand the presidency in the same way, you're liable to think, wait a minute, one of the pages fell out.
The executive power.
The executive power, and then it goes through, and you know, if you ask yourself, okay, the executive power, awesome. You know, what power does the president have? Well, it turns out that if you're just going by the text, he has very little power. He can receive ambassadors, and he can request the opinions in writing of the heads of the executive departments, and he can issue pardons, and that seems to be pretty much it in terms of his sole powers. He has some shared powers, making treaties and making appointments to federal office. But from day one of the new country, presidents, beginning with George Washington, who was one of the authors of the Constitution, have basically looked at Article 2 and said, you know, what am I supposed to do with this? I can't do anything with this. You know, it doesn't tell me what to do. I'll just do what I need to do, and you guys will work it out. So we have this continuing battle. And I once wrote an article about the presidency called The Ill-Made Prince, because we really have designed the presidency, not simply designed it poorly, but not designed it at all. It's just sitting there mysteriously on the page. It's like an ink blot that each of us projects our fears and hopes onto. So if you compare those two sections, these are the two of the most important sections in the Constitution, These are written at the same time by the same group of people, and yet they're so very different because they really didn't know what a president would look like.
It's Weekly Constitutional. I'm Stuart Harris, and I'm speaking with author and law professor, and I think maybe secret poet, Garrett Epps, all about his book, American Epic, which has just been issued in paperback. And Garrett's thesis is an interesting one. It's that the Constitution, when read as a whole, is really rather like an epic poem. After the break, we'll have our Madison Minute, and then we'll finish our discussion with Garrett Epps. Stick around.
I see a sad procession, and I hear the sound of coming footed bugles. All the channels of the city streets are flooding, as with voices and with tears.
Madison's concern for a stronger union impinged on almost every issue he faced. He was delighted, for example, when in May 1784, Patrick Henry offered resolves in the Virginia legislature that money due to the Confederation be based on population rather than land valuation, and that unpaid requisitions be forcibly collected by, quote, distress on the property of the defaulting states or of their citizens. Madison observed pointedly the next year that, quote, a single frigate under the orders of Congress could make it the interest of any one of the Atlantic states to pay its just quota. Confederacy-wide measures and the power to compel obedience were also necessary to prevent ultimately self-defeating commercial disputes among the states. Moreover, foreign humiliation often resulted from the opportunity other nations had to intrigue and play one state against another. With a Madison Minute, I'm Jim Blaylock.
And now it's time to finish our discussion with law professor Garrett Epps, who thinks that the American Constitution is sort of like an epic poem, and that, like many poems, there's a certain magnificent ambiguity to certain aspects of it. It turns out that one of the most ambiguous parts of the Constitution is Article 2, which created the presidency.
There had never been a chief of staff, chief of state, called a president before. That's the first thing to realize. And John Adams and a number of other people, including Hamilton, thought that the title of the chief executive of the new country would be governor. Akil Amar of Yale, who's written a lot on the Constitution's text also, has a theory that the reason it ended up being called president was that everybody knew that the first head of state in the new country would have to be George Washington. Otherwise, the country would fall apart.
Right.
And George Washington was at the convention. He had a very specific role. He was president of the convention. So every time someone makes a speech, they were looking at Washington and saying, Mr. President, I believe such and such. So by the end of the whole thing, president seemed very natural. The other interesting thing you can glean from Washington's presence at the convention is that to some extent, people were afraid to talk in much detail about the president's powers because they were afraid of showing disrespect to the president. And there was a moment where one of the members of the convention early in the convention says, you know, we haven't talked about the executive much. That's a kind of a blank in the Virginia plan. I propose the executive be one person. And that was pretty radical at the time because most of the states then as now have multiple executives.
Mm-hmm.
He said, I propose that it be one person. Well, you know, this was this kind of a scary thing to a lot of people because it seemed so much like a king. But what Madison records in his notes from that moment is a considerable silence ensued. Nobody spoke. Until finally, someone said, well, then I guess we're all agreed. And at that point, Benjamin Franklin spoke up and said, no, let's have a debate. What the hell? and so it got debated over a number of times. But I as I reconstruct that, what's going on is that a lot of the people in the room were nervous about trusting that much power to one person, but they were even more nervous about saying that with Washington in the room, because it would seem like an aspersion on his character, which Washington would not stand for.
No, I can see how, what you're saying there, because you're talking sort of generically, theoretically, about some future president and how to limit his powers, but you're afraid that Washington's going to take it personally.
Absolutely. And they were terrified of Washington. He spoke up very rarely on the record.
Because he didn't have to.
Right. Well, I mean, but that was his, that was his view of executive authority, was you held on to it for when it was needed.
Let me pick up on that idea. I didn't mean to interrupt you there, but that's among the many things that makes George Washington so important. And the more I learn about him, the more I recognize his importance, is that given this ambiguous statement, the executive power, and then that's so few limitations that are placed on it or even explanations, everything he did as president set precedents.
Yes.
Every act he took, I mean, from even that silly discussion, seemingly silly, about how to address him, took on huge significance. And he set the tone for many years. In fact, it was well over 100 years before another president even dared run for a third term, because he had set that limit himself.
That is true. And I think that when you can really spend a lot of time and have a lot of fun if you're interested in these topics, simply studying how the Washington administration solved problems that arose from the ambiguity of the text, because most of the arguments we have today are foreshadowed in arguments that were conducted between 1789 and 1797.
Wouldn't you have loved to sit in on those cabinet debates between Hamilton and Jefferson?
Well, yeah, but I mean, the main thing to realize is, Hamilton was the guy doing it, and Jefferson didn't have that much to say about it. He was constantly being outflanked, because Hamilton had been on Washington's general staff. Hamilton was brilliant. Hamilton was utterly loyal to Washington. Washington understood perfectly well that he couldn't trust Jefferson. No one could trust Jefferson. So as a result, when Washington had a problem, he basically went to Hamilton and said, fix it. And in all the major areas of executive power, beginning with the war power, foreign relations power, how it relates to Congress, who has control over the executive departments, all of these things, it was Hamilton who set the tone, and Hamilton who created the terms of the debate we're still carrying on today.
I think he's the most underappreciated founder.
He is, part of it is that, he didn't live long enough to complete his legacy, and part of it is that his obituaries were written by his enemies. Madison and Jefferson, particularly Madison, really hated him by the end of his life, and they tried to make sure his party collapsed, and of course, the Adams family hated him also, so he really didn't leave a lot of friends behind, and they were very careful to try to minimize his contribution to the new government. But I think if you'd ever really been able to get Washington to talk about what he thought, he would have cheerfully said, I owe more to this country, and I owe more to Hamilton than to any other human being. And I think that's probably true, for better or worse. Not everything Hamilton stood for was something that we think is great. But he was so smart and so energetic and so always ready to tackle the big problem that he was this, he was known throughout the Washington administration. Many people called him the prime minister.
Yeah.
And that came from the fact that the first lord of the treasury in England was what became to be known as the prime minister. But it also was because Washington used him that way. Solve this problem for me, go talk to Congress, get this worked out. I'm Washington, I don't do this stuff, you do it. And he did it so well.
He did indeed. In fact, one of my favorite museum exhibits I've ever been to was back in 2003 at the New York Historical Society. It was the 200th anniversary of course, the duel at Weehawken. And it was simply called, I'm paraphrasing, but something like The Nation That Hamilton Built. Mm-hmm. And right. the whole thrust of it was a comparison of what we have today and what Hamilton wanted us to be, and it's remarkable how often he won the debate. It's just remarkable.
Yes, absolutely.
But hey, before we go on, we still want to get back to the text. The history is always fascinating. But before we go, what is the single most quirky or unusual or strange or delightful bit of the Constitution that no one's ever heard of?
Boy, there's a lot of things that you could talk about there. But let's first of all talk about the Third Amendment. You know, now quick, all my friends out there in the unseat audience, what is the Third Amendment about?
It's my favorite amendment, but go ahead.
It says that there should be no quartering of troops in private homes in time of peace, and only in times of war as specified by law. So I often say to people, you know, I make speeches to civic groups, and I say, you know, if you go home tonight to your house and you notice the complete absence of uniformed military personnel sleeping on your couch and so forth, you should thank the Third Amendment, because it is an enormous success, because it's so clear. It dealt with a very specific abuse that was the Quartering Act that was passed in the 1770s, so that the British could send troops to the colonies and have a place for them to sleep. And it's very clear in, it says you can't do it, right? So that if someone comes in and says, I've got a great idea, let's all have our troops live in people's houses in time of peace, you know, the answer is you're an idiot, you can't do that. It's written right down on a piece of paper, so it doesn't happen. Now, what's fascinating to me about the Third Amendment is that there has been one case in the history of the Republic that was brought under the Third Amendment and won under the Third Amendment, one and only one case. And I actually, in writing the book, had the opportunity to call the lawyer who brought that case. He lives in, his name is Mr. Sussman, Alan Sussman. He lives in Bearsville, New York. He's pretty much retired at this point. But he brought a case against the state of New York, because when the correctional officers at the Attica prison went on strike, they sent the National Guard to Attica, and the National Guard not only took over the prison, but they took over the barracks in which the correctional officers lived while on duty, and evicted them from that and used the troops for the barracks. And Mr. Sussman, who was then a fairly young labor lawyer, brought a claim that this violated the Third Amendment. And of course, as you can imagine, the government lawyers, when they served with this, thought, they didn't just think this is ridiculous. They thought, Third Amendment, this must be a misprint.
Yes, look this one up.
Yeah, that's exactly. But he won. He won. The judge said, yes, the Third Amendment is incorporated against the states by the due process clause of the 14th Amendment. And yes, this violates it.
And this was state-owned housing.
No, actually, what happened was that they would pay rent.
So they were renting it. Okay.
Yeah. So it was built by the state, but then there was the interest that a lease gives you. So they had that possessory interest. They were ousted of it. And he said, because this is the first case ever, I'm not going to award you any damages because the law wasn't clearly established. So, you know, in constitutional law, you can often lose a case by winning it. But still, he's the only person in the world, in the nation's history, to win a case under the Third Amendment. And when I talked to him, I said, this is an enormous honor. And he thought that was hilarious, because to him, this wasn't a particularly important part of his legal career, since he didn't actually get any damages as a result. So that's a wonderfully quirky part of the Constitution. The 17th Amendment is a very complicated part of the Constitution, and I'm happy to say that I'm one of the few lawyers in American history to bring and win a case under the 17th Amendment,
Means you need to brag. Tell me.
Well,
first of all, what's the 17th Amendment do?
The 17th Amendment, as we know from school, is popular election of senators. Mm-hmm. But what's interesting is that it permits a number of states to allow the governor of the state to make a temporary appointment of a senator when a senator resigns.
Okay, just a little background. In the original Constitution, senators were appointed by state legislatures.
Right.
This was an important part of states retaining some power in the national government.
Exactly.
Okay, but for a series of reasons we don't have time to go into, it's certainly involving allegations of corruption, bribery, and the rest of it, and also as part of the Progressive Era and the gradual expansion of our democracy, the 17th Amendment gets enacted so that now, since then, the people directly elect their senators in each state. Okay, that's the basic thrust of the 17th Amendment.
Exactly, but if you read the Constitution about the House and the Senate, you'll see something interesting. That is, when a member of the House resigns or dies in office, there must be a special election held. That seat is empty until an election is held. But when a senator dies in office or resigns, the governor may, under state law, make a temporary appointment. And so the question then is, does that mean the governor could just appoint someone to serve the rest of the senator's term? If you read the text of the 17th Amendment carefully, my answer is no. It has to be a temporary appointment. If it was for the entire rest of the term, that wouldn't be temporary. That would be a permanent appointment, because of course he can't appoint the person to serve more than the six-year term of a senator. So what happened in 2008 was that Senator Barack Obama was elected president. And
I heard of that guy.
Yeah, he's still around somewhere. And his seat was vacant, and we've all had the opportunity now to read the transcripts of Governor Blagojevich explaining that a Senate seat is a bleeping valuable thing, and I'm not giving it away for nothing, and I'm going to get something for it. And he was determining whom he would appoint, and he finally ended up appointing this fairly embarrassing figure, Roland Burris, to serve the entire remainder of Senator Obama's term. And working with some progressive lawyers in Chicago, we brought a suit against the state saying Senator Burris cannot have the entire term because that's not a temporary appointment. There has to be a special election. Now, this is like the guy winning the case under the Third Amendment, because the case took sufficiently long to be heard. We went up to the Seventh Circuit. In the Seventh Circuit, they said, you're absolutely right. We're ordering a special election held. However, there's so little time left between the end of the term that the special election will be held on the same day as the general election to choose the senator for the next term, which means the winner of the special election would win a one-month term as senator.
Oh, boy.
But rather quixotic as this victory may be,
you established a precedent.
Well, not just that. I think Senator Kirk is probably very grateful to us because he, of course, won the new term. He also won the extra month, making him senior.
Oh, to everybody else in his class.
Exactly. 1 month of seniority, and that's quite important. I have never run into him, but when I do, I expect him to thank me and offer me lucrative office and so forth. But, you know,
that's a great story, Garrett.
The 17th Amendment is a terrific thing. So the Constitution has all these little craters and so forth, little places you can find things. The 25th Amendment is another thing people should look at.
Oh, and I'd love to talk about it, Garrett, but we're going to have to leave it there. We're going to have to whet people's appetite. But I do want to say this. The next time I have a controversy over my own election to the Senate, or the next time I come home and I find a red coat on my couch, I know who I'm going to call.
I'm your guy. You got to come to me.
And that's our show. Thanks so very much to Garrett Epps of the University of Baltimore Law School. And yep, I Googled him. I checked it. He was, in fact, an English major. Our executive producer is Wayne Winkler. Our scheduler is Carol Hutchinson. Our music is by the Watauga Fife and Drum Corps. Our scheduling engineers are Chad Barrett and Bob Hoffman. And our Medicine Minute is by the incomparable Jim Blaylock, who's not so much epic as he is magnificently ambiguous. My name is Stuart Harris, and remember, you are a part of the American experiment.